Hello, this is Lois Pausch reading the Vermillion County News for Friday, January the 11th, 2019. And the first article has the headline, Nonprofit has Vermillion New Place to Do Good. Dateline Danville, for years, Fairhope Children's Ministry, which provides clothing and other items to children throughout Vermillion County, had been operating out of the Bowman Avenue United Methodist Church parsonage. It's been very good for us, longtime volunteer, Roberta Williams said of the small two-story house at 908 May Street. But Williams, who schedules clients' appointments, and director Carol Volpert, said the nonprofit organization has needed for the past several years a different building, one that has space, that's handicapped accessible, and that's on one level. Currently, we have to store our spring and summer clothes on the second floor and our winter things downstairs in the basement, Volbert said. We are a volunteer organization, and a lot of our volunteers are older, and like me, they can't do stairs, she continued with a laugh. After 4 years of searching, the ministry has acquired a new facility at 1225 East Voorhees Street through a donation. Now members hope to raise about $200,000 to completely renovate the building. Fairhope is a cooperative ministry of the Batestown, Bowman Avenue, Catlin, Farber's Chapel, First, St. James, and Union Corner United Methodist Churches. It began providing new and gently used clothing and bassinets and cribs to children in Danville and the surrounding communities in 2004. It now provides clothing from newborn through size 18, layettes for newborns, which include a handmade quilt, personal care items and clothing, play yards for infants, convertible car seats, and backpacks and school supplies. In the 2017-18 fiscal year, it provided 550 families with basic clothing needs for 1,040 children, 40 portable play yards, 100 layettes, more than 250 backpacks and school supplies. Clients are referred to the ministry by local social service agencies, schools, churches, and healthcare facilities. Each client is scheduled for a 30-minute shopping appointment. Volunteers assist clients launder and mend donated items, shop, knit, crochet, and sew quilts, and restock racks and shelves. The ministry is funded through donations from churches, community groups, service organizations, and businesses, grants from local foundations, and individual donations. Donations of clothing and school supplies are also welcomed. Williams and Olivia Humphreys, the group's secretary, looked at a number of buildings over the past 4 years, but for some reason or another, they weren't suitable. They looked at the Voorhees Street property, which once housed George's Buffet, then later was used as a union hall early on, but at the time, the price was too high, given that the building needed a new roof and other work. More recently, they heard through the grapevine that it was still available, so they took another look at it. When the owner heard they had still not found a building, he offered to donate it. Ken Merrill, the group's treasurer and building committee chairman, said the facility has 9,500 square feet, is one level, and handicapped is accessible. Williams pointed out it's on a city bus line. People have donated to us so generously, Volpert said. It will be nice to be able to put everything out on the floor where they can access it easily. We also have room for our storage and organization. While the shell is structurally sound, Merrill said it needs a new roof, new plumbing and electricity, a new furnace, ceiling and doors and walls that need to be reconfigured. Williams said the group has enough money to fix the roof. While the committee hasn't put together a renovation budget yet, she estimates it will take another $200,000 before the building can be occupied. We're hoping we will have it done in a year or sooner, but that will depend on when we can raise the money, Volpert said, adding the group is working on a couple of grants. And the next article has the headline, Election Petition Appeal Denied. Dateline Danville. A Vermillion County Circuit Court judicial review ruling on the Danville Election Commission's decision in the Ward 2 alderman race means voters in the ward still have two candidates to choose from in the April election. Judge Derek J. Gurton Thursday afternoon ruled that the Election Commission's Board of Commissioners decision stands. The Election Commission Board last month ruled against Ward 2 Alderman candidate Jerry Hawker's filed objection to Ward 2 Alderman Rick Strebing's election petition paperwork not being dated and fastened correctly. Hawker was trying to remove Strebing's name from the election ballot, claiming Strebing didn't follow election laws. "I don't see where there is a failure to substantially comply," Gurton said. He said the date on the forms turns out is correct because there is no primary needed. Also, Gurton said the binder clip used to fasten Strebing's 4 pages of election petitions is sufficient. If it were hundreds of papers, such as a candidate running in Cook County election, that would have been different and could involve the possibility of tampering. Gurton also said Hawker and his attorney, Eric Eves, with Acton and Snyder, were basically asking Gurton to decide the election instead of Ward 2 voters. He added the case law says the petitions have to be substantially in compliance. Prior to Gurton's ruling, the Board of Commissioners attorney, Chuck Devins, said, "This is also much ado about nothing, Your Honor." Devins said this stated the binding clip can't be removed, and the date was when the general election is to be conducted. Hawker's attorney, Eric Eves, with Acton and Snyder, went through case law and said the possible primary date and proper fastening of petitions are mandatory requirements of the election code. Eves also said no record or testimony under oath were taken and that he was not properly notified through a correct email for the Danville Election Commission's reconvened hearing for the board's December decision. Hawker was there alone for the board's decision. Eves said a written decision of the board's findings also didn't happen. Strebing has said Danville Election Commission staff told him to put the general election April 2 date on his petitions. The Board of Commissioners last month ruled the date was substantially in compliance with election laws regarding filing to run for office. Danville Election Commission Executive Director Sandy Delhay also said she'd put a paperclip on Strebing's paperwork due to Strebing wanting a copy of them. Strebing had sufficient paperwork binding according to state law, the Board of Commissioners said. And the next article has the headline, "Jury Finds Man Guilty of Sexual Assault of Child." Dateline Danville, a Vermillion County jury returned a verdict of guilty Thursday against Joseph S. A. Johnson of Georgetown for the offense of predatory criminal sexual assault of a child. During a 2-day jury trial, evidence showed in April 2016, a juvenile female disclosed to her mother that while she had been in Johnson's care, he committed an act of sexual penetration upon her, according to information from the Vermillion County State's Attorney's Office. During the investigation, it was learned that Johnson had committed multiple sex acts against the juvenile for a number of years. Law enforcement also discovered a second child victim who disclosed that Johnson had committed various acts of sexual penetration upon her as well while she was in his care. Johnson will be sentenced on March 14th by Circuit Court Judge Nancy S. Fahey. Predatory criminal sexual assault of a child is a Class X felony and carries a sentencing range of 6 to 60 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections. Johnson will be required to serve 85% of his sentence. The case was investigated by investigator Sean Jones and retired Sergeant Todd Damilano of the Vermillion County Sheriff's Department. The case was prosecuted by Assistant State's Attorney Stephanie Weber and Michael Paul. Sexual predators take advantage of some of the most vulnerable members of our community, including our children, and they must be brought to justice, Jacqueline M. Lacey, State's Attorney, said in a press release. The Vermillion County State's Attorney's Office will continue to work aggressively to prosecute those engaging in preying on our children, she said. And now for the obituaries. And the first is for Charlotte Ann Stehst, 77 of Danville, who died on Tuesday, January 8th, 2019. Her funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, January 12th at Calvary Baptist Church, Danville. Officiating will be Pastor Don Hessler. Burial will be in Resurrection Cemetery, Danville. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 11th at Calvary Baptist Church in Danville. Memorials may be made to the Calvary Baptist Church or the Humane Society. And the next is for Alma H. Bolton, 75 of Danville, who died on Tuesday, January the 8th, 2019. Alma's wish was for cremation. Private family services will be held. And the next is for James Larry Wilson, who died on January 4th, 2019. Funeral services will commence at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, January 12th at Second Baptist Church, 940 North Franklin Street, Danville. Visitation will be from 9 a.m. until the time of the service. Pastor Frederick Cowan officiating. Interment will be at Spring Hill Cemetery. Visitation will be 1 to 5 p.m. with family present from 4 to 5 p.m. On Friday, January 11th at Leek & Sons Funeral Home, 304 East William Street in Danville. And the next is for Jamie Edward, quote-unquote, J. Miller Smith, 46, who died on Sunday, January 6th. A homecoming celebration will commence at noon Saturday, January 12th at Lighthouse Ministries, 122 Ohio Street, Danville. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. until the time of the service. Officiating will be Pastor Bobby Keys. Interment will be at Sand Hill Memorial Cemetery. And the next is for Michael C. Wagner, 70 of Danville, who died on Monday, January 7th, 2019. Masonic services by Further Light Lodge, 11:30, and Bible presentation by the Danville Fire Department will take place at 12:30 p.m. Sunday, January 13th, at Kruger Cohen Pape Funeral Home, 10 East William Street, Danville. A visitation will follow from 1 to 3:30 p.m. Sunday, with funeral services beginning at 3:30 p.m. with Pastor John Boudouris officiating. Private family burial will take place at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made in Michael's name to Further Light Lodge, 11:30. And the next is for Clifford Jolly, 92 of Fairmont, Illinois, who died on Wednesday, January 9th, 2019. Private funeral services will be held at Robeson Chapel in Catlin. Burial will be in Stern Cemetery in Fithian with military honors. Public visitation will be from 2 to 6 p.m. on Sunday, January 13th at Robeson Chapel in Catlin. Memorials in Cliff's memory may be made to St. James United Church, United Methodist Church, or Caleb McGee Medical Fund in care of Robeson Chapel, P.O. Box 79, Catlin, Illinois, 61817. And the next is for Terry Lee Tibbett, 76, of Covington, Indiana, who died on January 9th, 2019. A celebration of Terry's life will be held at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday, January 14th, at Sunset's Covington Chapel, 420 3rd Street, Covington, Indiana, 47932, with Pastor Mike Hohenstein officiating. Visitation will be from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Sunday, January 13th, at the funeral home with Masonic rites at 5 p.m. He will be laid to rest in Mount Hope Cemetery in Covington. Memorials may be made in his name to the American Cancer Society. The next is for Mary Ann Miller of Danville, Illinois, who died on January 9th, 2019. Service will be at 2 p.m. Monday, January 14th at Spring Hill Mausoleum Chapel with Pastor Randy Downing officiating. Entombment will take place at Spring Hill Cemetery and Mausoleum. Memorials may be made to the Rock Church, 20 Poland Road, Danville, Illinois. Danville, Illinois. It looked like it was going to go on from there. Sorry. And now the next is for Dr. Joseph Carinato, 80, of Danville, who died at on January 9th, 2019. A massive Christian burial for him will be at 10 a.m. Monday, January 14th, at St. Paul's Catholic Church, 1303 North Walnut Street, Danville. Father Greg Nelson will officiate. Entombment will be in Sunset Memorial Park. Visitation will be from 3 to 6 p.m. Sunday, January 13th, with a 2:30 p.m. rosary service prior at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center, 3940 North Vermilion Street, Danville. The family requests memorials be made to the Schlarman Foundation, OSF Foundation, Danville Symphony Orchestra Foundation, or the DACC Foundation. And now we go to community briefs. The first three are from Danville, and the first has the headline, KFC Plans Meal. The Knights of Columbus, 310 Bryan Avenue, plan a fish fry from 5:30 to 7 p.m. today. The menu will include fish or chicken strips for $7 or breaded shrimp for $8. Children under 12 will be $4. Also, Left for Dead Band will play 7:30 to 11:30 p.m. Saturday at the Knights of Columbus, 310 Bryan Street. This band features all acoustical guitars. All are welcome. And the next has the heading Beauty of Hope Pageant. The Beauty of Hope Benefit Pageant will have its 7th annual meet and greet from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday at Crossroads Christian Church. The nonprofit pageant raises money for the American Cancer Society. Learn more at www.beautyofhopepageants.com. And the next brief has the headline, CASA Plans Training. CASA of Vermilion and Edgar County is in need of volunteers to better serve our community. Hundreds of abused and neglected children in Vermilion and Edgar counties are involved with the juvenile court and welfare system. These children need an advocate whom they can depend on to fight for their best interests. Court-appointed special advocates, that's CASA, are trained volunteers whose role is to be the child's quote-unquote voice in court. CASA seeks volunteers who are older than 21 and can spare at least an hour a month. The next training begins January 22nd. Contact Lauren or Liz at 217-446-5975 or apply at casavermilion.org under the volunteer tab. And the next brief is from Hoopston, and it has the title, Library Gives Away Books. The Hoopston Public Library will give away books left over from its December book sale. The books will be available during the next week only. And now a news article with the headline, Holocaust Project. Dateline Newtown. Anyone stepping into David Parker's 7th grade English language arts classroom at Oakwood Junior High School would be overwhelmed by what they saw. Every table surface in the entire classroom is covered with handmade models of concentration camps in meticulous detail. The intricate displays are just one part of a much larger project on the Holocaust that Parker's 78 students are working on year-long. This is a museum, not a classroom, Parker said. Parker, who has long been a history teacher, now teaches language arts and decided to use the tragic time in world history not only as a springboard to literature and writing exercises that would inform his students about the Holocaust, but also to teach them life lessons about discrimination and racism that still exist today. When I used to teach history, the Holocaust was a paragraph and a half in the textbook, Parker said. 13 million innocent people lost their lives because of the way they were born. I thought if we're going to read about it and write about it, why not bring in my knowledge of the history of it, he said of the Holocaust. The students had 1 month, roughly between Thanksgiving and Christmas, to complete the miniature displays, write a thoroughly researched and error-free paragraph about a concentration camp, and create a 25-slide or more presentation following grammar rules and citing works from their research. What the students turned in right before winter break more than impressed Parker. In 32 years of teaching, this is the most creative group of students I've ever had, he said. It almost made me cry when I saw how much work they've put into this. They were receptive of the project, and I'm pretty proud of them, he added. The models they did at home at night and on weekends, Parker said. Some of them are so large they had to be brought to school in the back of a pickup truck. Seventh grader Caleb Frazier admitted that he didn't know a lot about Auschwitz before he started working on his replica of the camp. Caleb said he cut small wooden rods that he used as fence posts that he stretched wire across, as well as for the smokestacks of the incinerator. Seventh grader Hayden Thomason worked in collaboration with his classmate Alec Harrison to create a large replica of Auschwitz, complete with a train and military figures. Hayden's dad helped cut all the wood for the camp's wooden towers, 2 dozen barracks, and other structures. I didn't know anything about the Holocaust before this, Hayden said. Fellow seventh grader Yelka Layden said the classroom project opened her eyes as well. I knew who Hitler was, but I didn't know much about the Holocaust, she said. I learned so much about it and what a tragedy it was. The students will continue to learn more about that era during the second half of the school year. The topics that will be touched upon during the year-long project include the rise of Hitler and Nazism, Anne Frank in hiding, concentration camps, the final solution, Jewish rights taken away, arrest and relocation, Dr. Joseph Mengele and the twin experiment with Eva Kaur, Nuremberg trials, resistance groups, liberation of Europe, Star of David, and the D-Day invasion. So far, the class has read Number the Stars and watched the movies The Boy in the Striped Pajamas and The Diary of Anne Frank. We've read and written about Anne Frank, Parker said. Future assignments include reading The Boy on the Wooden Box by Leon Lacen and Surviving the Angel of Death by Holocaust survivor and Terre Haute Indiana resident Eva Moses Kaur, who along with her twin sister Miriam was subjected to human experimentation under Dr. Joseph Mengele at Auschwitz. Parker would like to be able to take his students on a field trip to Kandel's Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Terre Haute, which Kaur founded, and have the students meet Kaur in person, but he said he hasn't been able to secure a grant to fund the trip. Another part of the project next month was to write a thorough Last month, I'm sorry, was to write a thorough paragraph about a concentration camp. Our goal is to write one error-free paragraph, Parker said. They formulated a question, used author's words to report a main idea, made a personal connection to it, and then explained how they felt about that connection. For many of the students, the personal connection was profound. It's really important not to judge people based on religion or race, Caleb said. We should treat everyone the same. Hayden said, it's unfair how they were treated. It's not right. I've always been around a group of positive people, but with the Holocaust, there's no meaning to it but pure hate, he said. All people are the same, no matter what their religion or race is. Because of the project, Parker said he hopes his students become better readers, better writers, and take what they've learned and become a better person. I want them to be accepting of everyone, he said. And the next article has the headline, Skelton Museum, Dateline Vincennes, Indiana. In September of 1967, Red Skelton wrote a letter to his then-wife, Georgia, as he so often did, expressing some thoughts he had about patriotism. On January 14, 1969, 50 years ago, he shared those thoughts with the world. That's what I find really cool about this whole exhibit, said Ann Pratt, director of marketing at the Red Skelton Museum of American Comedy. We discovered this letter he wrote to Georgia, where he essentially wrote down what he ended up saying a year and a half later. He says to her, I think I like to do this on my show. I think our country needs it right now. The country was in the midst of turmoil surrounding the Vietnam War when Skelton recited his rendition of the Pledge of Allegiance on his popular TV show. He was upset about all the flag burning during the Vietnam protests, said Mark Kratzner, the museum's curator and archivist. Just before he did the pledge, there had been a flag burning in Central Park. He was just really affected by how people were disrespecting the flag, and he wanted to remind people of the pledge. The museum later this month will be unveiling a new exhibit centering around Red's Pledge of Allegiance and all the publicity that followed it. The collection features numerous awards and recognitions from veterans organizations like the American Legion and VFW, as well as original records of the pledge and Red's own patriotic paintings. The exhibit also includes a copy of his letter to Georgia, as well as letters of appreciation sent to Red from congressmen. And the highlight of the exhibit, the original script from which he read when he recorded the pledge in front of a live audience in December 1968. The pledge first aired when Skelton was in the prime of his career, Pratt said. It was an all-American TV show, one that prided itself on family values. That year, in 1969, she said the Red Skelton Show, which premiered in 1951, was at the top of the ratings charts, yet the world around him was changing, becoming ever more volatile and political. TV, Pratt said, was becoming edgier, which is why most people believed the show was canceled just 2 years later. But the pledge gave Red's fans a peek at a different side of his personality. While everyone knew him for his effortless comedic style, few knew just how patriotic he was. And the pledge solidified for fans his thoughts on the political climate. He was always a patriotic person, Krasner said. And I think this showed people that. It showed them that he wasn't always a jokester, that he thought about our country and the things that were happening in it. It was just a side of him that wasn't always in the public eye. The pledge was read aloud to Congress four times in 1969 and another three times in the years that followed, Pratt said, including the day he died, September 17, 1997. Pratt is hopeful, she said, that members of Congress will publicly read it again for this, its 50th anniversary. Museum officials will host a kickoff celebration open to the public at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday. The exhibit will then officially opens on Tuesday and will remain open through September 8th. Sponsoring this collection are both Niehaus Lumber and the Vincennes Tourist Bureau. Now an opinion column from the Bloomington Pantograph. And it has the headline, New Laws Reflect New Times. Perusing new laws instituted in Illinois for 2019 can be at once entertaining and enlightening. We find laws we can't imagine had to be written and ones we couldn't imagine could ever be written. The list is an opportunity to measure how we've changed or even consider what laws might be considered antiquated 500 or 100, 50 or 100 years from now or even next year. One of the fascinating new laws is one requiring the Secretary of State to update Illinois' Rule of the Road Driver's Handbook. The addition of information on the Dutch reach method of opening car doors. While sitting in the driver's seat at the curb, the Dutch reach involves reaching across the body with the right hand to open the door, thereby encouraging a glance over the shoulder at oncoming traffic. The method is taught in the Netherlands. Illinois is the second state after Massachusetts to enact the Dutch reach. That's a common sense thing we should have been doing before now. There are overdue refinements of existing laws. The Department of Corrections will be required to collect and report violence in prisons and publish public safety reports. They'll include numbers of assaults, sexual assaults, contraband, weapons, suicide, and segregation. We don't expect these numbers to please every person who's reading the reports, but those are things that we should know and need to know about our prisons. Carnival operators must conduct criminal background checks on every ride operator they employ. A background check was previously required, but state officials had no capacity to revoke a violator's permit. And that's all I can read for now because I've run out of time. And I look forward to reading to you with you again soon. This has been Lois Pouch reading the Vermilion County News for Friday, January the 11th.